Be really obvious if you stop and think about it. You ready for it? The church is the people. What I mean is the church is made up of the people. It's easy to prove. If you take away people, you no longer have a church, right? You take the people out of the church, it's no longer a church. So if someone came to me and said, "What is Grace Fellowship Church?" I could answer, Grace Fellowship Church is Tushara and Shida Chandrasena. Grace Fellowship Church is Raffi and Isabel Asalian. It is Greg Shunk. It is Alex and Dorcas Ajay. It is Linda Bartzi. We could go on and on. The church is the people. I'm going to add another statement that's also quite obvious. The church is like the people. And what I mean is that the character of the church, the character of the corporate church, is determined by the character of the individual people. So if somebody says, "What is Grace Fellowship Church like?" I could answer, Grace Fellowship Church is like Tushar and Shida. It's like Raffi and Isabel. It's like Greg. It's like Alex and Dorcas. It's like Linda. The church is the people, so the church is like the people. That's a thought I just want you to hold on to as we start looking at this passage that Dwight just read for us, Luke chapter 6, beginning in verse 37. The church is the people, so the church is like the people. Just hold on to that thought. We'll keep returning to it. And in this passage we're looking at today, Jesus is going to challenge us, I hope, with this thought. The character of the church is determined by the character of the people of the church. So think about it. If a church is marked by suspicion, that's the tone of the congregation. It's just a suspicious place to be. Why is that? Well, that must be that the people themselves are marked by suspicion. Or if you go into a church that's just generally angry, generally gossipy, why is that? It's because the individual members of the church are generally angry. They're generally gossipy. On the other hand, you go into a church that's warm, that's welcoming, that's forgiving. That's just because the individuals who make up the church are warm and welcoming and forgiving. The church is the people, so the church will be like the people. So with that in mind, I want to ask a few questions, and that'll form our structure, our outline. I think you've got this in your song sheet there in front of you. These questions I'd like to work our way through over the next few minutes. The first one is this: what do we want this church to be like? We already know who the church is. The church is the people. So let's ask then, what do we want this church to be like? And once we determine what we want the church to be like, we need to ask this: who do we want to be like? Who will we follow? Who will we follow as we try to become the kind of church we've determined we'd want to be? And then we'll come to our third question, which is, what is our main priority? Once we know what we want to be like, and once we know who we want to be like, what is the foremost priority that falls to each one of us as individual members of this church? So the first question then is this: what do we want this church to be like? What qualities of character should mark this congregation? As we look at these verses, starting in Luke chapter 6, verse 37, we've dropped into the middle of a sermon that Jesus preached relatively early in his ministry. Last time I was up here, we looked at the verses that come right before this, where Jesus was talking about how to relate to your enemies. In today's passage, he's not talking anymore about how to relate to outsiders, to enemies. He's talking about how to relate to insiders, to brothers and sisters, members of the same spiritual community, you could say. And his interest in these verses is the character of the community that his followers will form. And he begins with four quick commands. Two of these commands tell his followers what they must not do, and two of these commands tell his followers what they must do. And in each case, he follows with a blessing that will come to the whole community as the people choose to obey. So there's four commands And there's four blessings. And I just need to point out, when he talks about you, he uses the word you here. In English, we use one word that says the same to a group of people or to an individual. He's talking to the group here. When he says you, he's looking out at his followers as a whole. And so he's saying y'all or you guys or something along those lines. Verse 37 then, he says, judge not and you will not be judged. Condemn not and you will not be condemned. Two things his followers must not do. You must not judge, and you must not condemn. And there are two blessings that will come as they obey. You won't be judged, and you won't be condemned. Two things they must not do, and two blessings that will come. He goes on, he says, forgive, and you will be forgiven. Give, and it will be given to you. So two things they must do. You must forgive, and you must give. And then two more blessings that will come as they obey. You will be forgiven, and things will be given to you. And so what he's done here, just right out of the gate, he's told his followers how they must behave, and then told them how that behavior will prove to be a blessing within the entire community of believers. And if we just pause and think about this, what we can see Jesus doing here is essentially setting up two different kinds of community. He's looking out at his followers and saying, you can go this way and set up this kind of community, or you can go that way and set up that kind of community. So let me tell you about those two options he's laying out for them here. The first option, this is a kind of community his followers could set up, but he's warning them not to create this kind of community. I'll give you its four major characteristics. First, it's a community of judgment. A community of judgment where the people are constantly scrutinizing one another's lives. And as they do that, they're looking in each other's lives for evidence of sin, evidence of failure. And then they're just harshly judging people for what they see there. There's so much nitpicking, so much ruthlessness going on. So first, it's a community of judgment. It's also a community of condemnation. So people are looking for each other's flaws. They're looking for each other's failures, each other's foibles. And then they're being hard-hearted. They're being compassionless when they see those things. The third thing, third mark of this community, is it's a community of resentfulness. The people here are harboring grudges. They're slow to repent when they sin against someone else. They're slow to grant forgiveness when someone sins against them. And the fourth mark, it's a community of selfishness. Every person is looking primarily for his own interests rather than looking out for the interests of other people. I don't know about you, but that doesn't sound like much of a community to be part of. It's marked by judgmentalism and condemnation and resentfulness and selfishness. Why? Why is the community marked by those awful behaviors? Well, there's only one good explanation, is that the individual members are marked by those awful behaviors. There's a kind of law of reciprocation going on here. Reciprocation just means you're receiving back what you have given. So the people in the church are being judged. Why? Because they themselves have judged others. People in this church are being condemned. Why? Because they themselves condemn others. Forgiveness comes slowly to people. Why? Because forgiveness comes slowly from people. No generosity is being received by people in need because no generosity is being given by those who could help a need. As we said before, the church is the people, so the church will be like the people. The ungodly character of this community we've just looked at here, it's just a reflection of the ungodly character of the individuals. So there's the first option. The community, Jesus is saying, you could set this one up. I'm warning against it, but there's the one way you could go. What's the second? This is the community Jesus is calling for. Let me tell you about its four major characteristics. It's a community of acceptance, where people accept each other. They're very slow to scrutinize one another. If they are scrutinizing anybody, they're scrutinizing themselves, their own lives, rather than one another's. It's a community of compassion. Yeah, of course people see each other's flaws and failures. They experience their sin, but they respond with warm hearts. They respond with compassion. They respond with patience. The third mark, it's a community of forgiveness, where people are quick to come to others to say, please forgive me, and where people are very quick to grant forgiveness when it's been asked. And then the fourth mark, it's a community of generosity. It's just normal for the members of this community to experience the generosity of others. It might be generosity with money or with time or attention or whatever people need. There's someone there to help them meet their needs. This community sounds quite a lot better than its opposite, doesn't it? It's accepting, it's compassionate, it's forgiving, it's generous. And again, we need to ask why. Why is this community marked by such great behaviors? Well, it's because the individuals in that community are marked by those wonderful behaviors. That same law of reciprocation is going on. People are not being judged because they themselves are not judging one another. People here are not feeling the harsh condemnation of others in the community because they're not being condemning towards others in the community. Forgiveness comes quickly when they've wronged someone because forgiveness comes from them quickly when they're the ones who have done the wrong. And they're receiving generosity because they themselves have joyfully extended generosity. Again, the church is the people, so the church will always be like the people. The godly character of this church just reflects the godly lives of its individual members. Jesus gives a little picture here that helps illustrate the law of reciprocation that we can expect in the local church. And when I started studying this passage, this more than anything else confused me. What's going on in this odd little illustration here? Verse 38. He says, good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. You got to think about that one for a minute and transport yourself back 2,000 years to ask, what would have been going on there? What would this have meant to those people? Imagine that you're wearing a long robe, as people would have in that day. And somebody wants to give you a gift of grain, something you could take home. They're giving you a gift of generosity to help feed your family. How would you take that gift of grain home? What you might do is grab the bottom of your robe and lift it up to form a giant pocket. And that person would start to pour grain into that pocket. And as it began to fill, he would shake it and he would press down on it. And he would just keep pouring and pouring until it flowed over. That's the illustration Jesus is using here. A picture of somebody giving generously to you. And then Jesus tells us the lesson that's in the illustration. He says, with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. Now, I'm sure this points most directly to what he's just said about giving, but I'm sure it extends to everything he said from the very beginning here. The same principle applies to everything. If you give with generosity, you can expect to receive with generosity. But more, if you forgive much, you can expect that you will be forgiven much. But if you're big into condemnation, you're big into judgment, you're just looking out at the church week by week, full of judgment and condemnation in your heart, you can expect that you yourself will receive judgment. You yourself will receive condemnation. Why? Because the church is the people. The church will always be like the people. Which means that you influence the church corporately by the way you behave individually. The church takes on the character of its individual members, which is, of course, a great challenge for each one of us, isn't it? Let's think about this. If you're personally in the habit of standing in harsh judgment of other people in this church, you are helping to create and to foster a church-wide spirit of judgmentalism. If you criticize people, you rant about them, you cut them down, you grumble about them, you gossip about them, you condemn them in your own heart. You're not just doing that as an individual, you're doing that as a part of a community, part of a church. And then, with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. which means if you're going to behave in that way, you should not be surprised when other people in the church make judgments towards you. Why? You have helped create that culture in the church. You've helped foster that culture in the church every time you've done it. But of course, the opposite is true as well. If you're personally in the habit of overlooking offenses, it's your habit to believe the best about other people, to love them despite their sins, what are you doing? You're helping to create and foster a church-wide spirit of grace. And again, with the measure you use, it will be measured back to you. So we need to ask, do you feel a freedom to condemn people in this church? That might be just in the quiet of your own home, in the quiet of your own heart. Do you harbor grudges against people here? Do you find yourself scrutinizing them? Maybe scrutinizing them, their lives on social media, nitpicking, judging, especially for things that are matters of conscience or matters of Christian freedom. What goes on in your heart? What comes out of your mouth right after a members' meeting when you're sitting just by yourself or sitting with your family? If you freely judge and condemn others, if you just fail to extend grace to other people, you're influencing the whole church. You're helping to create and foster the spirit of condemnation, of judgment, of harboring grudges. Because, as you know by now, the church is the people, so the church will always be like the people. The church is you, so the church will in some ways be like you, the individual. You choose, get this, you choose day by day what this church community will be like. You choose day by day through your character what the character of the church community will be. You do that simply by the ways you behave. So that's our first question. What do we want this church to be like? And I hope our answer is we want it to be marked by love. Love that's expressed in acceptance and compassion and forgiveness and generosity. All those things that Jesus has talked about here. Which means we can ask our second question, which is, who do we want to be like? And we need to ask this one because we are all natural imitators. So if we're going to ask the question of what do we want to be like, we also then need to ask, who do we want to be like? Who do we want to imitate? In order to take on good traits, we need to follow good leaders. We need to have good examples. Of course, if we follow bad leaders or give ourselves over to bad examples, it won't be long before we're showing bad traits. As we move to verse 39 then, Jesus offers a little parable that makes a very serious point. Can a blind man lead a blind man? Will they not both fall into a pit? So here you can picture a blind man. He needs to get somewhere. And there were no guide dogs in those days, no white canes, no sidewalks. The roads were unpaved, lots of holes, lots of ruts. It was not easy to be blind, and it was really impossible to be totally self-sufficient or independent as a blind man. He needs help. And this man needs to travel somewhere. He needs a traveling companion. So he cries out, can somebody help me? He hears a friendly voice saying, I'll help you. And so he takes the arm of this friendly stranger, and off they go. But what he doesn't realize is he's taking the arm of another blind man. So what happens? They barely get underway, and then they both fall into a hole. Can a blind man lead a blind man? No, not if you want to get where you're going. So what's Jesus teaching here? We need to move to verse 40 to see how he extends his teaching there. A disciple is not above his teacher, but everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. Now, in that day, if you wanted to learn, you needed to find a teacher. You needed to find a rabbi. You couldn't just go on YouTube and start watching videos. You needed to find a person, a teacher. And what you would do is deliberately put yourself under that man's influence. The more you are with him, the more you would become like him. In fact, you knew you had been fully trained when you were fully like him. You would know everything he knows. You would behave in all the ways he behaves. You would be a full-on imitator of that man. So I think you'd want to be very careful that you chose that person well. You'd want to choose a very good teacher. Some people chose bad teachers. You remember how Jesus referred to some of the religious leaders of his own day? He called them blind guides. That sounds familiar here, doesn't it? Blind guides. These were the ones. They were the blind leading the blind straight into the pit, straight into hell. So people would take them on as a teacher, and they would become imitators of the Pharisees, the legalists, the false teachers. And the longer they followed them, the more they would imitate their arrogance, their legalism, their false teaching. Then Jesus came along. He started his teaching ministry, and he said, "Follow me." He said, "I am the light of the world." He proved he's the one who gives sight to the blind, both literally, physically, but also spiritually. So Jesus called people, his disciples first, and then others, "Follow me, be like me, be my imitators, be fully trained by me." Jesus was their good teacher, and Jesus is our good teacher. So who do we want to be like? We want to be like him. Now the disciples could actually follow him. They could actually follow in his steps, literally be with him to become imitators of him, but we cannot. He's not physically here for us to follow. So how do we follow Jesus? How do we imitate him? Broadly, there's two ways. First, we read about him in the Bible. The Bible is the revelation of Jesus Christ. The whole thing reveals him. And so we read the Bible, and we get to know Jesus in the pages of the Bible, and we imitate Jesus. But then we also need to follow people who are already following him. We need to find people who are already like Jesus and then imitate them. That means we need to choose our influencers very well. We need to choose our elders well. We need to choose our authors well. We need to choose our podcasters well. We need to choose our mentors well, because for good or ill, we will become like them. As we give ourselves to their teaching, we'll begin to imitate them. So if we want to be a church that's accepting, a church that's compassionate and forgiving and giving, we can't allow ourselves to be influenced in a significant way by people who are judgmental, people who are forgiving. We need to find people who exemplify generosity, who exemplify forgiveness, ultimately Jesus, but then also people who have become like Jesus, people who have followed him and become fully trained by him. You know, we can flip this around and apply it to people who lead as well. We've talked about who we need to follow, but how are we going to lead? If you have people following you, parents, for example, you need to lead like Jesus leads. Think about this. Parents, if in the home you are judgmental and condemning and harsh about other people in the church, maybe you're complaining about people in the car on the way home, maybe you're just kind of blowing off steam or ranting around the dinner table, your children will imitate you. They'll come to imitate you in being judgmental and condemning toward other people in the church. Jesus said, everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher, which is like saying every child, when he's fully grown, will be like his mom, like his dad. But if you're forgiving and generous toward other people in the church, if you speak well of them and you're deliberate in affirming God's grace as you see it in their lives, your children will learn to be forgiving and generous. You'll be creating that atmosphere in the home. You'll be creating that atmosphere in the church. Parents, think about this. Everyone, when he is fully trained, will be like his teacher. You're a teacher to your children. So our second question was, who do we want to be like? Ultimately, we want to be like Jesus and to be like the people who are most closely following Jesus. We need to imitate them, and as we do so, we'll exhibit those wonderful virtues that grow a church, that strengthen and protect a church. One last question to ask, and it's this: what is our main priority? We've asked what we want this church to be like. We've answered we want it to be accepting and compassionate and forgiving and generous. We've asked who we want this church to be like. We've answered we want it to be like Jesus, and so we're following him and being influenced by people who are like him. Now we need to ask, what is our main priority? Really, what is your main priority? Jesus switches here. He's not talking to the group as a group anymore. He's talking to every individual within that group. He's using the other form of you now, the singular form of you. And Jesus uses a funny little parable here to make a serious point. Verse 41, why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but you do not notice the log that is in your own eye? How can you say to your brother, brother, let me take out the speck that is in your eye, when you yourself do not see the log that is in your own eye? This one's easy to picture. Kids, maybe you've tried to picture this one before because it's pretty funny. You've been outside maybe doing a little home improvement project here, and I guess suddenly there's like something collapses or there's a big explosion or something like that. I don't know what happens. But as the smoke settles, as the air begins to clear, you look over and you see your friend, and your friend's holding his eye. And he's saying, I got some sawdust in my eye. You go rushing over to help him. You want to help your friend. So you say, let me take a look. I'll get it out for you. But your friend just kind of looks frightened and he backs up. He says, I think you're the one who needs to get some help first. See, what he knows that I guess you're ignoring is that you got a little something in your eye too. Not a speck of sawdust though. It's actually a log. It's a plank. Actually, the word Jesus uses here is roof beam. You've got the single biggest piece of wood in the whole house sticking into your eye. So while you're trying to get a microscopic little speck out of your friend's eye, you've got a 30-foot-long beam of wood sticking out of your own eye. Here's what Jesus says, verse 42. You hypocrite. First, take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take out the speck that is in your brother's eye. This is not brain surgery. Well, it kind of is, isn't it? This is not hard to figure out. You can't do microsurgery on someone else's eye when you've had major trauma to your eye. You need to deal with your own major mess before you can help someone else deal with their minor mess. Now, it's very interesting to me, and I think it's very important that Jesus describes this as hypocrisy. Hypocrisy is a moral word, which means in Jesus' mind here, you haven't just made a mistake, you have committed a sin. So what's hypocrisy? Hypocrisy is when you have a very high standard for everyone else, but a very low standard for yourself. So hypocrisy is when a politician says, everybody needs to wear a mask, but then she's spotted in public, and sure enough, she's not wearing a mask. That's hypocrisy. Or hypocrisy is when a prosperity preacher tells people, you need to give generously, but he does that so that he can spend lavishly. Hypocrisy is when parents are super, super careful about what their kids watch on Netflix while they themselves just watch whatever they want. Hypocrisy. And in the context of what Jesus is saying here, hypocrisy is when you care more for other people's sin than your own sin. It's when your great concern is not your own flaws, but the flaws of other people in the community. It's when you're scrutinizing other people to look for sin, but you never carry out any serious self-examination. It's when you approach them to deal with their sin, but you rarely confront yourself with your own sin. And I guess in this context, Jesus must mean especially those sins that destroy a Christian community. Judgmentalism, condemnation, grudges, selfishness. See, here's the thing. Jesus is not saying, he's not making the point, there's never a time to go to another Christian and help him see his sin. That's not true. We need other people. We need people sometimes to help us identify our sin. Maybe think about it this way. If you've ever had a little speck in your eye, you know it can be very, very miserable. Even a tiny little speck can just hurt so much. And when you have a speck in your eye, you're desperate for someone to help you get it out. But if you go to the doctor to get her help, and you show up at the doctor's office, and she's got a 30-foot beam of wood sticking out of her face, you'll probably decide to go to a different doctor. Why? Because the beam doesn't just make her unqualified to help you get your speck out, it actually makes her incapable. She doesn't have the vision. It's impossible for her to do it. She'll mess it up. She'll just make it worse. And just like it's miserable to have a speck in your eye, it's miserable to have a nagging sin in your life. Just like you want someone to help you get the speck out of your eye, you want someone to help you get that sin out of your life, to help you identify it and put it to death. But that person needs to be qualified. What's the qualification? The qualification is that that person is following Jesus. She herself has put her sin to death. She's already got that metaphorical plank out of her eye. When she's done that, now she's qualified. Now she's capable to help you identify your sin and put it to death. So the question we've asked, what is your main priority? Your main priority is dealing with your own sin. Your main priority is demanding holiness of yourself, not of everyone else, not of the other church members, not of your other family members, your spouse, your children. Your main priority, demanding holiness of yourself. Your main priority is to admit you've got some planks in your eyes. You need to be far more concerned about getting them out than going and digging out the specks in someone else's eye. That's how you do your part in building a church that's accepting, that's compassionate, that's forgiving, that's generous. You probably heard this quote from Robert Murray M'Cheyne before. He said, "For every look at yourself, take 10 looks at Christ." For every look at yourself, take 10 looks at Christ. What he was trying to teach is that the way to grow in godliness is not to fixate on your own sin, but to fixate on Christ, on his glory, on his beauty, on his holiness. And it's very, very good counsel. And maybe in light of our passage today, we should add something to it. For every look at someone else, take 10 looks at yourself. And hopefully this will align your priorities. That means for every one look at someone else, you're taking 10 at yourself and 100 at Christ. Your first concern will be to orient yourself toward Jesus Christ. Your second concern will be to do that self-examination. Your third concern would then be to look toward others and help them with their sin. Well, as we began today, I said Jesus was going to challenge us with this thought: the character of the church is determined by the character of the people of the church. And I hope he's challenged us corporately and each one of us personally. The church is the people. This church is the people. So this church will be like the people. This church is you. So this church will be like you. You individually, I'm talking to you right now. You will see your character reflected in this community. It's inevitable. As we wrap up here, let me ask just one more question. Who do we want this church to be? We know the church is the people, it is the members, but if you're not a member of this church, we do want you to know there's an open invitation to join us as we attempt to be that church community Jesus is calling us to be. If you're a Christian, but you're not a member of a church, why not join us? We're taking on a challenge here together that's worthy of the gospel, the challenge to be a church that reflects the character of Jesus Christ. And if you're not a Christian, why wouldn't you put your faith in Jesus? Why wouldn't you believe the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ? And then join us. Join us as together we follow him. Let me pray. Our Father, we thank you for sending Jesus into this world so we could follow him. We know how to be godly. We know how to honor you because you've given us this example in the flesh, Jesus Christ. So it's our prayer that we would faithfully follow him, knowing that the church is the people and will be like the people. We pray for each one of us that we would have character that is worthy of imitation. Pray that each one of us would want to be like Jesus so we can create a community that's marked by his presence, marked by his character. We pray these things in his name. Amen.